Welcome back. We're talking about Roe versus Wade. How can we not talk about Roe versus Wade? I'm a legal analyst. I'm a legal talk show host. I'm a practicing lawyer. And this is really a very monumental and historic overturning of a significant right that we had for 50 years. And I'm surprised we're not getting more texters and phone messages. 312-981-7200. We have a texter who said, why would anybody care what the next guy does if it doesn't hurt anybody else? It's not like these wackos walking around with guns shooting each other. The court will allow the states to make their own abortion laws, but will not allow the states to make their own gun laws. And I appreciate that sentiment, and not to get academic on you, but I think the idea is that according to the overturning of Roe versus Wade, there never was a constitutional right for a woman to have an abortion, and therefore it's up to the states to make their own laws on that, whereas the Second Amendment gives people the right to have a gun. And there you go. But I understand your sentiment. You know, these are very, very emotional issues. These are just issues that, you know, we're trying to break it down from a legal standpoint. But again, I hear the pain of people on both sides of this issue, and I'm trying not to inflict my opinion on anyone here. Our next guest, John J. Donahue III, is a professor of law at Stanford Law School. We've got a lot of smart people on our show this afternoon. He's also a research professor with the American Bar Foundation. He's been one of the leading empirical researchers for over 30 years. He is an economist, a PhD from Yale, and also a lawyer, for Harvard educated. And he's known for using empirical analysis to determine the impact of law and public policy in a wide variety of areas, including abortion. Welcome so much. So thank you so much for joining us, Professor Donahue.
Good to be with you.
And I know you're driving today, and you pulled over on the side of the road to weigh in on here, and I do appreciate that. Let's talk about your study. Now, you have studied abortion not from the viewpoint of morality or religion, or even so much the legal part of it, but really from a statistical viewpoint. Can you tell our listeners what your studies have found regarding the legalization of abortion and how it's affecting and has affected society?
Yeah, happy to. And I did get into this particular question because I was essentially trying to understand why in the 1990s, particularly the 8 years during the Clinton administration, that we had such a massive drop in crime. And in the course of trying to figure out why there was such a drop in crime, the idea came to me that the legalization of abortion in 1973 would improve the lives of the children that were born and essentially put them on a better life path and would reduce the subsequent criminality. But it takes like 18 to 20 years before you start to see those crime effects. And that corresponded very tightly with the pattern of crime reduction that we saw in the 90s.
So let's look at this. So when there is a legalization of abortion, what happens to children, born children, unborn children? What changes the dynamic regarding, how is that tied together to criminality?
Yeah. So of course there are extreme cases, and then the more general case. Probably the one case that I stumbled across that was most riveting to me is that the single worst mass shooting anywhere around the world was actually in Norway by a guy named Anders Breivik, who killed something like 90 people in a mass shooting where he was killing school children on an island. And it turns out that his mother had sought an abortion. She had a lot of mental illness struggles, but she sought the abortion just after Norway cut off the ability to have that abortion. And this child was born into very, very dire circumstances. The mother rejected the child completely, abused the child. The authorities wanted to take the child away, but ultimately he remained with the abusive mother and ended up going down this path of crime. So that's, of course, the most extreme case. But in general, what we know is that the life circumstances, particularly early life circumstances of the child, matter greatly to the course of their life prospects. And if you allow mothers to make the choice at which time they would like to bring children into the world, they do a lot better than if you know the government is telling them when they have to bring a child into the world, because there are all sorts of circumstances that might not make it advantageous. Either you're too young, you're in an abusive relationship, the pregnancy is a product of rape or incest. So all of these situations are outcomes that would lead to more adverse life experiences if those children are brought into the world, rather than allowing the mother to choose the timing for bringing children into the world and presumably choosing the optimal timing for her and her family.
And this sort of goes against the idea that women are reckless and careless and abort at any given time just by on a whim. You know, what you're saying is that these women are making pretty rational choices. Maybe they don't have a partner, or like you said, an abusive partner. Maybe they're young. Maybe they're in high school. Maybe they are in an impoverished situation. Maybe they have four kids already and not getting child support and not getting any child care does not have a father in the picture. And so when women make these decisions, they're making a good decision for themselves and for that unborn child who might, like you say, be raised in an environment that's not optimal. Very, very interesting. And now you've received probably a little bit of criticism with the idea that there is some kind of eugenics-ish element to this. But how do you respond to that, that this is sort of like, basically we're weeding out the bad in society by using abortion to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I have heard that criticism, but I do think it is a bit misguided because essentially the eugenics movement was all about restricting the ability of women to procreate with the idea that you would weed out bad elements. But legalization of abortion sort of did the opposite. It allowed the women to decide whether to have children or not. So rather than taking away the right to make that determination, this gave the women the right to make that determination. So it is true that I think the evidence is fairly clear that legalization of abortion does make the lives of women and the resulting cohort of children better, but without the sort of the malicious nature of a eugenics movement that would take away from certain people the ability to procreate.
We're talking to Professor John J. Donahue III, who's a professor of law at Stanford Law School. Can you hold a minute? We're going to come back, take a break, and when we come back, I've got some textures and I got some more questions for you.
Sure.
Okay. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. We're talking about the overturning of Roe versus Wade. I'm going to quickly read some of our textures from 815. Why can't the issue of pro-choice or pro-life be put on the ballot so all people can decide instead of just 9 people? Well, I think that's kind of what's going to happen. Maybe not a national referendum, but you're going to be voting for your legislators in your state. In Illinois here, we have a law that protects a woman's right to choose, so we're not going to be really affected by that as much as maybe some of the other states. From the 847 area code, more people have been killed by far by abortions than any firearms in COVID combined. I questioned that study, and I think what the texter was saying was that if you count the aborted fetuses as human beings, then that statistic is accurate, according to him or her. And there's always the option of adoption. Yes, I know. And there are so many ways not to get pregnant nowadays. It's called being a responsible adult. You know, when I hear those kind of things, I think punitive. I feel like you want to punish the woman for having sex without protection, or maybe it failed. Maybe she did use protection and maybe it failed. And what about the guy? I don't know. He doesn't have to take care of the child, I guess. Is killing people bad? That's the essential question here. From the 847 area code, men should never have a say about a woman's body. It's interesting to see people in strong marriages saying this will make families stronger. I feel they do not understand the repercussions this will have on females who are poor, single, and in horrible relationship. Mind your own uterus perfectly sums it up. So we've got people across the board obviously feeling very strongly about it, and I appreciate your comments, and I appreciate your your opinions. We are talking to Professor John J. Donahue, who's a professor of law at Stanford, and he has done some studies about the effect of legalization of abortion. You know, your studies, you know, are not talking about the morality of it, and or the religious aspects of it. You're really looking at the effects on society. And is this? Do you think that's a good way to kind of study this issue? In order, I mean, what is your goal in drawing the public attention to the ramifications of these types of laws or outlawing abortion?
Right. Well, as I said, I was a crime researcher, and really one of the most profound socioeconomic events of the last 100 years really was the enormous drop in crime that we saw during the 1990s. And so understanding that was extremely important because obviously we do want to keep crime down. And part of the story involved issues about guns, but part of it involved abortion. And it turned out the abortion effect was a surprisingly large effect in the United States. So I do think it's something that everyone should be cognizant of, and even the people who feel very strongly about abortion being morally wrong should be mindful that the consequences of restricting women's ability to choose when their families begin does come at a very high price for society. And therefore, if you're concerned about that high price, it's important to think about other ways to address those concerns rather than just say, tough luck on the poor women, and they're just going to have to live with a more troubled life and children with more troubled lives.
And, you know, this is sort of off topic, that our topic, Professor, but, you know, I wonder if we're going to see in these states, Mississippi and some of the states that are going to have outright restrictions or bans on abortion, if we're going to see child support laws be strengthened, if we're going to see child care be more readily accessible, and also medical care for pregnant women, you know, extending that so that if a woman is going to give birth and she maybe didn't want to in the first place, or she's impoverished, doesn't have a partner, doesn't have a support system, is she going to get the medical care necessary to make sure her baby is born healthy and the like? So that'll be an interesting that'll be something interesting to see if the legislators will come to the table on those issues. I'm going to switch topics a little bit, and this is another case that came down this week, another monumental case. This week, the Supreme Court struck down a 108-year-old New York law restricting people from obtaining concealed carry license. Apparently, in New York, it was very difficult to get a concealed carry. You'd have to show almost that you were like a private investigator or something like that, and the Supreme Court says, nope, we have a right to guns in our home, and we have a right to walk around with the gun, and you can't unduly restrict that right. Now, you've also studied the effect of concealed carry laws on violent crime. Can you talk a little bit about what your results are, Professor?
Yeah. So, again, this is an area that I've worked for many, many years, and it actually took quite a bit of research over the years to ascertain the full consequences of the movement towards permissive carry. But we now know that essentially, while there are sort of sporadic times where someone is able to use a gun effectively to thwart or deter crime, that on balance, the net effect of allowing more people to be carrying guns around is to substantially increase violent crime, and specifically firearm violent crime. And a host of unintended consequences are unleashed when you just allow anyone who wants to carry a gun to be able to do so.
You talk a little bit about the theft of guns. And again, you know, the more guns out there, the more guns are going to be used. And you do talk about theft. And I assume that theft of guns is a big problem because the people who are stealing guns are using them for illegal purposes.
Yeah, people don't realize that the single most common act of a gun and crime involves the theft of guns. It happens about 400,000 times a year, and about 100,000 times of those 400,000 thefts are caused by right to carry laws, because once you take the gun, outside the home, it is much more susceptible to theft and therefore has played a very substantial role in the increase in theft. And, of course, that means some hopefully law-abiding citizen has just armed the criminal, and that's obviously not something that we're excited to do.
And you also talk about police effectiveness being impacted by concealed carry. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, as we saw in the Uvalde shooting, police are really apprehensive about only one thing in life, which is the prospect of getting shot. No other thing besides a car accident or COVID is really a threat to a police officer, but they do feel and fear the danger of being shot. And so when you start allowing citizens to carry handguns, it changes the equation for police, and police are constantly in friction with citizens who are getting very angry at them for trying to stop them from speeding and giving them tickets and doing all sorts of other things. And so you're burdening police. And so one way to think about it is allowing permissive carry is like a tax on police. They've got to deal with the hundreds of thousands of gun thefts. They have to do all sorts of things that, you know, dealing with the accidents and lost and stolen guns. But they also are going to be much more cautious in approaching certain situations. And the consequence of this is we see a fairly significant drop in clearance rates of crimes. That's the rate at which police are able to solve crimes. And, of course, solving crime is one of the most important ways to reduce crime. And so when you impair police productivity, you get an increase in crime as a result of it. So many different ways, road rage, gun theft, impaired police productivity. Criminals start carrying guns more often when permissive carry laws go into effect. So a lot of bad things happen that most of the individuals who like the idea of concealed carry don't think about. And unfortunately, the justices of the Supreme Court seemed utterly ignorant of this array of unintended consequences.
John Donahue, Professor Donahue from Stanford Law School, thank you so much for joining us.